terrorists who were killed worldwide in 2018. And as always, for my wife Jamie and my children, Nicholas and Lily. What's done cannot be undone. Macbeth, 1606, Act 5, Scene 1. Forward. In August 2018, I commenced to work on a novel about a crusading young Arab prince who wanted to modernize his religiously intolerant country and bring sweeping change to the Middle East and the broader Islamic world. I set aside that manuscript 2 months later, however, when the model for that character, Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, was implicated in the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi dissident and columnist for the Washington Post. Elements of The New Girl are quite obviously inspired by events surrounding Khashoggi's death. The rest occur only in the imaginary world inhabited by Gabriel Alon, his associates, and his enemies. Empty Quarter of Solitude. Founded by a long-dead organization of multilateralism, Geneva International catered to the children of the city's diplomatic community. The middle school, where Beatrice taught reading and composition, educated students from more than 100 different countries. The faculty was a similarly diverse lot. The head of personnel went to great effort to promote employee bonding, cocktail parties, potluck dinners, nature outings, but in the staff room the old tribalism tended to reassert itself. Germans kept with other Germans, French with French, Spanish with Spanish. On that Friday afternoon, Miss Kenton was the only British subject present other than Cecilia Halifax from the history department. Cecilia had wild black hair and predictable politics, which she insisted on sharing with Miss Kenton at every opportunity. Cecilia also divulged to Miss Kenton details of the torrid sexual affair she was having with Kurt Schroeder, the Birkenstocked math genius from Hamburg who had given up a lucrative engineering career to teach multiplication and division to 11-year-olds. Ballet slippers were glossy and bright. She was proper, the new girl, modest. But there was something else about her, thought Beatrice. She was cut from different cloth. She was regal. Yes, that was the word, regal. She had arrived 2 weeks into the autumn term, not ideal but not unheard of at an institution like Geneva International, where the parent body came and went like the waters of the Rhone. David Millar, the headmaster, had crammed her into Beatrice's third period, which is already two pupils on the heavy side. The copy of the admissions file he gave her was gossamer, even by the school standards. It stated that the new girl's name was Jihan Tantawi, that she was of Egyptian nationality, and that her father was a businessman rather than a diplomat. Her academic record was unexceptional. She was deemed bright, but in no way gifted. A bird ready to take flight, wrote David in a sanguine margin note. Indeed, the only noteworthy aspect of the file was the paragraph reserved for the students, which point she received a mild rebuke from David Millar, the headmaster. It seemed Mrs. Tantawi wished to have no direct contact with Jahan's teachers. Beatrice was to state her concerns in an email to David, and David would address the matter with Mrs. Tantawi. Beatrice suspected he was aware of Jahan's real identity, but she knew better than to raise the subject even obliquely. It was easier to pry secrets from a Swiss banker than Geneva International's discreet headmaster, which left only Lucien Villard, the school's French-born head of security. Beatrice called on him on a Friday afternoon during her free period. His office was in the basement of the chateau, next door to the broom closet occupied by the shifty little Russian who made the computers work. Lucien was lean and sturdy and more youthful-looking than his 48 years. Half the female members of the staff lusted after him, including Cecilia Halifax, who had made an unsuccessful run at Lucien before bedding her sandaled Teutonic math genius. "I was wondering," said Beatrice, leaning with feigned nonchalance against the friends of others. Sarah was the perfect victim. 43, blonde, blue-eyed, brilliant, and unmarried. More important, it was common knowledge in the incestuous New York art world that she had access to a bottomless pit of money. "Are you sure you won't join me?" asked Boswell, as he raised the fresh glass to his damp lips. He had the pallor of roasted salmon, medium well, and a meticulous gray comb-over. His bow tie was askew, as were his tortoise-shell spectacles. Behind them blinked a pair of roomy eyes. "I really do hate to drink alone." It's 1 in the afternoon. You don't drink at lunch? Not anymore, but she was sorely tempted to renounce her vow of daytime abstinence. I'm going to London, blurted Boswell. Really? When? Tomorrow evening. Not soon enough, thought Sarah. You studied there, didn't you? The Courthold, said Sarah, with a defensive nod. She had no desire to spend lunch reviewing her curriculum vitae. It was Zizi Al-Bakari, which went some way to explaining why Sarah was having lunch with the likes of Brady Boswell in the first place. Sarah had recently agreed to lend several lesser works from the collection to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. Brady Boswell wanted to be next in line. It wasn't in the cards, and Boswell knew it. His museum lacked the necessary prominence and pedigree. And so, after finally placing their lunch orders, he postponed the inevitable rejection with small talk. Sarah was relieved. She didn't like confrontation. She'd had enough of it to last a lifetime. Two, in fact. I heard a naughty rumor about you the other day.
Only one?
Boswell smiled.
And what was the topic of this rumor?
That you've been doing a bit of moonlighting. Trained in the art of deception, Sarah easily concealed her discomfort.
Really? What sort of moonlighting?
Boswell leaned forward and lowered his voice to a confiding whisper. That's your KBM's secret art advisor.
Of course.
Bad idea, Khalid. That's the same thing my father said when I told him I wanted to give the women of my country the right to drive.
The museum closes at 5:30.
In that case, he said, you should expect me at 6. 3. New York. It was Tranquility, reputedly the second largest motor yacht in the world, that gave even his staunchest defenders in the West pause for thought. The future king saw it for the first time, or so the story went, from the terrace of his father's holiday villa on Mallorca. Captivated by the vessel's sleek lines and distinctive neon-blue running lights, he immediately dispatched an emissary to make inquiries as to its availability. The owner, a billionaire Russian oligarch named Konstantin Dragunov, knew an opportunity when he saw one and demanded 500 million euros. The future king agreed, provided the Russian and his large party leave the yacht at kingdom's support for Islamic zealotry and terrorism. Or was he merely trying to impress the smart set in Georgetown and Aspen? For reasons Sarah could not explain to friends and colleagues in the art world, she initially counted herself among the skeptics. And so she was understandably reticent when Khalid, during a visit to New York, asked to see her. Sarah eventually agreed, but only after first clearing it with the security division at Langley, which was watching over her from afar. They met in a suite at the Four Seasons Hotel, with no bodyguards or aides present. Sarah had read the many laudatory pieces about KBM in the Times, and had seen photographs of him wearing a traditional Saudi robe and headdress. In his tailored English suit, however, he was a far more impressive figure, eloquent, cultured, sophisticated, dripping with confidence and power, and money, of course. An unimaginable amount of money. He intended to use a small portion of it, he explained, to acquire a world-class collection of paintings. And he wanted Sarah to serve as his advisor.
Surprised I let you into the country.
I really shouldn't be seen with you, Khalid. The hand hovered between them. Quietly, he said, I am not responsible for Omar Nawaf's death. You have to believe me.
Once upon a time, I did believe you.
So did a lot of other people in this country. Important people, smart people. We wanted to believe you were somehow different, that you were going to change your country and the Middle East. And you made fools of us all. Khalid withdrew his hand. What's done cannot be undone, Sarah.
In that case, why are you here?
I thought I made that clear when we spoke on the phone. And I thought I made it clear you were never to call me again. Ah, yes. I remember. From the pocket of his overcoat, he drew his phone and played Sarah's last message.
And by the way, Your Royal Highness, I hope you rot in hell.
Surely, said Sarah, I wasn't the only one who left a message like that. You weren't, Khalid returned the phone to his pocket. But yours hurt the most. Sarah was intrigued.
Why?
Because I trusted you.
and because I thought you understood how difficult it was going to be to change my country without plunging it into political and religious chaos. That doesn't give you the right to murder someone because he criticized you. It's not as simple as that, isn't it? He offered no retort. Sarah could see that something was bothering him, something more than the humiliation he must have felt over his precipitous fall from grace. May I see it? He asked. The collection? Is that really why you're here? He adopted an expression of mild offense. Yes, of course. She led him upstairs to the Al-Bukhari wing. Nadia's portrait, painted not long after her death in the empty quarter of Saudi Arabia, hung outside the entrance. She was the real thing, said Sarah. Not a fraud like you. Khalid glared at her before lifting his gaze toward the portrait. Nadia was seated at one end of a long couch, shrouded in white, with a and her fingers bejeweled with diamonds and gold. A clock face shone moonlike over her shoulder. Orchids lay at her bare feet. The style was a deft blend of contemporary and classical. The draftsmanship and composition were flawless. Khalid took a step closer and studied the bottom right corner of the canvas. There's no signature. The artist never signs his work. Khalid indicated the information placard next to the painting. And there's no mention of him here, Ayla. He wished to remain anonymous so as not to overshadow his subject. He's famous? In certain circles. You know him? Yes, of course. Khalid's eyes moved back to the painting. Did she sit for him? Actually, he painted her entirely from memory. Not even a photograph? Sarah shook her head. Remarkable. He must have admired her to paint something so beautiful. Unfortunately, I never had the pleasure of meeting her. She had quite a reputation when she was young. She changed a great deal after her father's death. Zizi Al-Bukhari didn't die. He was murdered in cold blood in the old port of Cannes by an Israeli assassin named Gabriel Alon. Khalid held Sarah's gaze for a moment before entering the wing's first room, one of four dedicated to Impressionism. He approached a Renoir and eyed it enviously. These paintings belong in Riyadh. Nadia entrusted them permanently to MoMA and named me as the caretaker. They're staying exactly where they are. Perhaps you'll let me buy them. They're not for sale. Everything is for sale, Sarah. He smiled briefly. It was an effort. She could see that. He paused before the next painting, a landscape by Monet, and then surveyed the room. Nothing by Van Gogh? No. Rather odd, don't you think? What's that? For a collection like this to have so glaring a hole? A quality Van Gogh is hard to come by. That's not what my sources tell me. In fact, I have it on the highest authority that Zizi briefly owned a little-known Van Gogh called Marguerite Gachet at her dressing table. He purchased it from a gallery in London. Khalid studied Sarah carefully. Shall I go on? Sarah said nothing. The gallery is owned by a man named Julian Isherwood. At the time of the sale, an American woman was working there. Apparently Zizi was quite smitten with her. He invited her to join him on his annual winter cruise in the Caribbean. His yacht was much smaller than mine. It was called Alexandra, said Sarah, cutting him off. Then she asked, How long have you known? That my art advisor is a CIA officer? Was. I no longer work for the agency, and I no longer work for you. What about the Israelis? He smiled. Do you really think I would have allowed you to come anywhere near me without first having a look into your background? And yet you pursued me. I did indeed. Why? Because I knew that one day you might be able to help me with more than my art collection. Khalid walked past Sarah without another word and stood before Nadia's portrait. Do you know how to reach him? Who? The man who produced this painting without so much as a photograph to guide his hand. Khalid pointed toward the bottom right corner of the canvas. The man whose name should be right there. You're the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Why do you need me to contact the Chief of Israeli Intelligence?
My daughter, he answered. Someone has taken my daughter.
5. Astara, Azerbaijan. Sarah Bancroft's call to Gabriel Alon went unanswered that evening, for as was often the case, he was in the field. Due to the sensitive nature of his mission, only the Prime Minister and a handful of his most trusted senior officers knew his whereabouts. A moderate-sized villa with ochre-colored walls hard along the shore of the Caspian Sea. Behind the villa, rectangular plots of farmland stretched toward the foothills of the eastern Caucasus Mountains. Atop one of the hills stood a small mosque. 5 times each day, the crackling loudspeaker in the minaret summoned the faithful to prayer. His long quarrel with the forces of radical Islam notwithstanding, Gabriel found the sound of the muezzin's voice comforting. At that moment in time, he had no better friend in the world than the Muslim citizens of Azerbaijan. The nominal owner of the villa was a Baku-based real estate holding company. Its true owner, however, was Housekeeping, the division of the Israeli intelligence service that procured and managed safe properties. The arrangement had been covertly blessed by the chief of the Azerbaijani security service, with whom Gabriel had cultivated an unusually close relationship. Azerbaijan's neighbor to the south was the Islamic Republic of Iran. Indeed, the Iranian border was only 5 kilometers from the villa, which explained why Gabriel had not set foot beyond its walls since his arrival. Had the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps known of his presence, it would have doubtless mounted an attempt to assassinate or abduct him. Gabriel did not begrudge their loathing of him. Such were the rules of the game in a rough neighborhood. Besides, if presented with a chance to kill the head of the Revolutionary Guard, he would have gladly pulled the trigger himself. The villa by the sea was not the only logistical asset Gabriel had at his disposal in Azerbaijan. His service, those who worked there referred to it as the office and nothing else, also maintained a small fleet of fishing boats, cargo ships, and fast motor launches, all with proper Azerbaijani registry. The vessels shuttled regularly between Azerbaijani harbors and the Iranian coastline, where they inserted office agents and operational teams and collected valuable Iranian assets willing to do Israel's bidding. A year earlier, one of those assets, a man who worked deep inside Iran's secret nuclear weapons program, had been brought by boat to the officer's villa in Astara. There he had told Gabriel about a warehouse in a drab commercial district of Tehran. The warehouse contained 32 safes of Iranian manufacture. Inside were hundreds of computer disks and millions of pages of documents. The source claimed the material proved conclusively what Iran had long denied, that it had worked methodically and tirelessly to construct an implosion nuclear device and attach it to a delivery system capable of reaching Israel and beyond. For the better part of the last year, the office had been watching the warehouse with human surveillance artists and miniature cameras. They had learned that the first shift of security guards arrived each morning at 7. They had also learned that for several hours each night, beginning around 10 o'clock, the warehouse was protected only by the locks on its doors and the surrounding fence. Gabriel and Yaakov Rosman, the chief of special operations, had agreed that the team would remain inside no later than 5 a.m. The source had told them which safes to open and which to ignore. Owing to the method of entry, torches that burned at 3,600 degrees Fahrenheit, there was no way to conceal the operation. Therefore, Gabriel had ordered the team not to copy the relevant material, but to steal it outright. Copies were easily denied. Originals were harder to explain. Furthermore, the brazenness of seizing Iran's nuclear archives and smuggling them out of the country would humiliate the regime in front of its restive populace. Gabriel loved nothing more than embarrassing the Iranians. But stealing the original documents increased the risk of the operation exponentially. Encrypted copies could be carried out of the country on a couple of high-capacity flash drives. The originals would be much harder to move and conceal. An Iranian asset of the office had purchased a Volvo cargo truck. If the security guards of the warehouse kept to their normal schedule, the team would have a 2-hour head start. Their route would take them from the fringes of Tehran, over the Alborz Mountains, and down to the shore of the Caspian. The exfiltration point was a beach near the town of Babulsar. The backup was a few miles to the east of Khazarabad. All 16 members of the team planned to leave together. Most were Farsi-speaking Iranian Jews who could easily pass as native Persians. The team leader, however, was Mikhail Abramov, a Moscow-born officer who had carried out numerous dangerous assignments for the office, including the assassination of a top Iranian nuclear scientist in the center of Tehran. Mikhail was the operation's sore thumb. In Gabriel's experience, every operation needed at least one. Once upon a time, Gabriel Alon would have undoubtedly been a part of such a team. Born in the Valley of Jezreel, the fertile plot of land that had produced many of Israel's finest warriors and spies, he was studying painting at the Bezalel Academy of Art and Design in Jerusalem in September 1972 when a man named Ari Shamron came to see him. A few days earlier, a terrorist group called Black September, a front for the Palestine Liberation Organization, had murdered 11 Israeli athletes and coaches at the Olympic Games in Munich. Prime Minister Golda Meir had ordered Shamron and the office to send forth the boys to hunt down and assassinate the men responsible. Shamron wanted Gabriel, a fluent speaker of Berlin-accented German, who could pose convincingly as an artist, to be his instrument of vengeance. Gabriel, with the defiance of youth, had told Shamron to find someone else. And Shamron, not for the last time, had bent Gabriel to his will. The operation was codenamed Wrath of God. For 3 years, Gabriel and a small team of operatives stalked their prey across Western Europe and the Middle East, killing at night and in broad daylight, living in fear that at any moment they might be arrested by local authorities and charged as murderers. In all, 12 members of Black September died at their hands. Gabriel personally killed 6 of the terrorists with a .22 caliber Beretta pistol. Whenever possible, he shot his victims 11 times, one bullet for each murdered Jew. When finally he returned to Israel, his temples were gray from stress and exhaustion. Shamron called them smudges of ash on the Prince of Fire. It had been Gabriel's intention to resume his career as an artist, but each time he stood before a canvas, he saw only the faces of the men he had killed. And so he traveled to Venice as an expatriate Italian named Mario Del Vecchio to study the craft of restoration. When his apprenticeship was complete, he returned to the office and to the waiting arms of Ari Shamron. Posing as a gifted, if taciturn, European-based art restorer, he eliminated some of Israel's most dangerous enemies and carried off some of the most celebrated operations in office history. Tonight's would rank among his finest, but only if it succeeded. And if it failed, 16 highly trained office agents would be arrested, tortured, and in all likelihood, publicly executed. Gabriel would have no choice but to resign, an ignoble end to a career against which all others would be measured. It was even possible he might take down the Prime Minister with him. For now, there was nothing Gabriel could do but wait and worry himself half to death. The team had entered the Islamic Republic the previous evening and made their way to a network of safe houses in Tehran. At 10:15 p.m., Tehran time, Gabriel received a message from the operations desk at Kingsall Boulevard over the secure link, informing him that the last shift of security guards had left the warehouse. Gabriel ordered the team to enter, and at 10:31 p.m. they were in. That left them 6 hours and 29 minutes to torch their way into the targeted safes and seize the nuclear archives. It was a minute less than Gabriel had hoped they would have, a small setback. In his experience, every second counted. Gabriel was blessed with a natural patience, a trait that had served him well as both a restorer and an intelligence operative. But that night on the shore of the Caspian Sea, all forbearance abandoned him. He paced the half-furnished rooms of the villa. He muttered to himself. He ranted nonsense at his 2 long-suffering bodyguards. Mainly, he thought about all the reasons why 16 of his finest officers would never make it out of Iran alive. He was certain of only one thing. If confronted by Iranian forces, the team would not surrender quietly. Gabriel had granted Mikhail, a former Sayeret Matkal commando, wide latitude to fight his way out of the country if necessary. If the Iranians intervened, a good many of them would die. Finally, at 4:45 a.m., Tehran time, a message flashed over the secure link. The team had left the warehouse with the files and computer disks and was making their escape. The next message arrived at 5:39 a.m. as the team was headed into the Alborz Mountains. It stated that one of the security guards had arrived at the warehouse early. 30 minutes later, Gabriel learned that the Najah Iran's National Police Force had ordered a nationwide alert and was blocking roads around the country. He slipped from the villa and, in the half-light of dawn, walked down to the shore of the lake. In the low hills at his back, the muezzin summoned the faithful, "Prayer is better than sleep." At that moment in time, Gabriel couldn't agree more. 6. Tel Aviv. When Sarah Bancroft received no reply to her phone call or subsequent text messages, she concluded she had no choice but to leave New York and fly to Israel. Khalid saw to her travel arrangements. Consequently, she made the journey privately and in considerable luxury, with the only inconvenience being a brief refueling stop in Ireland. Forbidden to use any of her old CIA identities, she cleared passport control at Ben-Gurion Airport under her real name, a name that was well known to the intelligence and security services of the State of Israel, and rode in a chauffeured car to the Tel Aviv Hilton. Khalid had booked the largest suite in the hotel. Upstairs, Sarah dispatched another text message to Gabriel's private mobile, this one stating that she had come to Tel Aviv on her own initiative to discuss a matter of some urgency. The message, like all the others, went unanswered. It was not like Gabriel to ignore her. It was possible he had changed his number or had been forced to relinquish his private device. It was also possible he was simply too busy to see her. He was, after all, the Director General of Israel's Secret Intelligence Service, which meant he was one of the most powerful and influential figures in the country. Sarah, however, would always think of Gabriel Alon as the cold, unapproachable man she encountered for the first time in a graceful red-brick townhouse on N Street in Georgetown. He had pried into every padlocked room of her past before asking whether she would be willing to go to work for Jihad Incorporated, which is how he referred to Zizi al-Bakari, the financier and facilitator of Islamic terror. Sarah had been fortunate to survive the operation that followed and spent several months recuperating at a CIA safe house in the horse country of Northern Virginia. But when Gabriel needed one final piece of an operation against a Russian oligarch named Ivan Kharkov, Sarah leapt at the chance to work with him again. At some point, she also managed to fall quite in love with him. And when she discovered he was unavailable, she began an ill-advised affair with an office field operative named Mikhail Abramov. The relationship was doomed from the beginning. They were both technically forbidden to date officers from other services. Even Sarah, when she analyzed the situation honestly, admitted the affair was a transparent attempt to punish Gabriel for rejecting her. Predictably, it ended badly. Sarah had seen Mikhail only once since then, at a party celebrating Gabriel's promotion to Director General. He had had a pretty French-Jewish doctor in his arm. Sarah had coolly offered him her hand rather than her cheek. When another hour passed with no response from Gabriel, Sarah went downstairs to walk along the promenade. The weather was fine and soft, and a few fat white clouds were scudding like dirigibles across the blue Levantine sky. She walked north past trendy beachfront cafes, among the spandexed and the suntanned. With her blonde hair and Anglo-Saxon features, she looked only mildly out of place. The vibe was secular and Southern Californian Santa Monica on the shores of the Mediterranean. It was hard to imagine that the chaos and civil war of Syria lay just over the border, or that less than 10 miles to the east, atop a bony spine of hills, were some of the most restive Palestinian villages of the West Bank, or that the Gaza Strip, a ribbon of human misery and resentment, was less than an hour's drive to the south. In hip Tel Aviv, thought Sarah, Israelis might be forgiven for believing the dream of Zionism had been achieved without cost. She turned inland and wandered the streets, seemingly without purpose or destination. In truth, she was engaging in a surveillance detection run using techniques taught to her by both the agency and the office. On Dizengoff Street, while leaving a pharmacy with a bottle of shampoo she did not need, she concluded she was being followed. There was nothing specific, no confirmed sighting, just a nagging sense that someone was watching her. She walked through the cool shadows of the china berry trees. The pavements were crowded with mid-morning shoppers. Dizengoff Street. The name was familiar. Something awful had happened on Dizengoff Street. Sarah was certain of it. And then she remembered. Dizengoff Street had been the target of a Hamas suicide bombing in October 1994 that killed 22 people. Sarah knew someone who had been wounded, an office terrorism analyst named Dina Sarid. She had once described the attack to Sarah. The bomb had contained more than 40 pounds of military-grade TNT and nails soaked in rat poison. It exploded at 9 a.m. aboard the No. 5 bus. The force of the blast hurled human limbs into the nearby cafes. For a long time afterward, blood dripped from the leaves of the chinaberry trees. It rained blood that morning on Isengoff Street, Sarah. But where exactly had it happened? The bus had just picked up several passengers in Isengoff Square and was heading north. Sarah checked her current position on her iPhone. Then she crossed to the opposite side of the street and continued south until she came upon a small gray memorial at the base of a chinaberry tree. The tree was much shorter than the others on the street, and younger. Sarah approached the memorial and scrutinized the names of the victims. They were written in Hebrew. "Can you read it?" Startled, Sarah turned and saw a man standing on the pavement in a pool of dappled light. He was tall and long-limbed, with fair hair and pale, bloodless skin. Dark glasses concealed his eyes. "No," answered Sarah at length. "I can't." "You don't speak Hebrew?" The man's English contained the unmistakable trace of a Russian accent.